Lucy takes close-up images of another asteroid. Why Mars has a lopsided magnetic field. Chinese engineers rescue a pair of satellites with gravitational slingshots and new hints about where Mars' carbon dioxide atmosphere went. And in our longer Space Bites Plus on Patreon, a proposed human mission to both Mars and the asteroid Ceres. All this and more in this week's Space Bites. NASA's Lucy spacecraft is on its way out to the Jupiter Trojan Belt, but they are testing out the instruments and the spacecraft, and they're doing flybys of asteroids in the asteroid belt. And we got another flyby from Lucy, this time from asteroid Donald Johansson. Now, if that name sounds slightly familiar, this is the paleontologist who discovered one of the ancestor fossils of humanity, the Lucy fossil. And so they named an asteroid after him. I guess they named it when they knew that Lucy was going to do the flyby, and then that was all together. Anyway, Lucy did the flyby of asteroid Donald Johansson. It came within 960 kilometers of the surface of the asteroid on April 20th, and then took a bunch of images every 2 seconds as it flew past. Now, this is a very small asteroid. It's only about 5 kilometers long, about 2 kilometers wide at its widest point, and yet it's another contact binary. You can see that at some point in the past, you had two separate asteroids that were orbiting around each other, and then they just got closer and closer and then merged into this space peanut. Again, we see this. So now with the flyby complete, Lucy is off to the Trojan Belt, and its next target is going to be the asteroid Eurybates, which is going to visit in August 2027, and now the full Trojan mission begins, and obviously we will keep you updated on that. And so if you want to find out more information, there's a great story on universetoday.com written by Alan Boyle. The remnants of a lopsided Mars magnetic field. One of the big problems with Mars is that it lacks a global magnetic field. This is something that we have here on Earth, and it protects us from radiation coming from the sun as well as cosmic radiation. Without that magnetic field, radiation just makes its way all the way down to the surface, and anyone who is on the surface is going to be exposed to high degrees of radiation. But we know that Mars did have a magnetic field billions of years ago. And the evidence is that, in fact, not only did it have a magnetic field, but it was a strange lopsided field where the southern hemisphere was more protected than the northern hemisphere. And that's really peculiar. And of course, Mars was so small that it cooled down and its internal dynamo shut off and it solidified and it could no longer protect itself. But why did it have this lopsided magnetic field? And so now scientists have done simulations, and it looks like the way you can explain it is if the core of Mars was liquid. Now, here on Earth, the core of the Earth is a solid, and then it's surrounded by a liquid. The core is spinning, you get this dynamo, that creates the magnetic field. But on Mars, the core was liquid. And one of the things that's really interesting is that the heat escaping from Mars tended towards the southern hemisphere. And we can see that the hemispheres of Mars are actually very different. You've got one region where you've got a lot of volcanic activity, the great volcanoes on Mars. You've got this region of uplift. And yet on the other hemisphere, things are lower, much less volcanic activity. And so the researchers explain that it's this lopsided magnetic field caused by this liquid core that was rotating at the center of Mars. We've got more information about this from Andy Thomaswick on Universe Today. And where did Mars's atmosphere go? Without that global magnetosphere, Mars wasn't able to protect itself from the solar wind coming from the sun. But it's believed that the atmosphere on Mars was a lot thicker in the past, billions of years ago, and we could see evidence that there was water on the surface of Mars for long periods of time. You can't get that without a very thick atmosphere. So where did the Martian atmosphere go? Unlike water, which has hydrogen, which is a very lightweight element and easily escapes into space, carbon is more difficult to release into space. And so it's believed that the carbon somehow got locked away into the rocks on Mars. The problem is that there are spacecraft orbiting Mars that have scanned the entire surface of the planet looking for these rocks, carbonates, that would be where carbon had been locked away into some kind of rock. And there just isn't enough of this carbonate material on Mars to explain that it absorbed its atmosphere. But Curiosity was drilling into a rock, it was down about 3 to 4 centimeters, and then it brought up material, which it could then analyze with its instruments, and found that this was a type of rock called siderite. And this is a carbonate, the kind of rock that you would get when carbon has been pulled out of the atmosphere and locked away. And so it might be that in fact, all of that carbon that was siphoned out of the atmosphere and into the rocks is just hiding underneath the surface with another layer on top of all of these rocks. And that's why they weren't able to be seen from space. And we've got another cool article about this from Andy Tomaswick over on Universe Today. Chinese engineers rescue some spacecraft. I love space rescue stories where you've got some impossible situation where a spacecraft has been put into the wrong orbit or something malfunctions and engineers come up with some clever solution like Apollo 13 to solve the problem. And in the end, everything works out great. And we got another one of these stories fairly recently. So there was a pair of Chinese satellites launched called DROA and DROB. And these are part of a larger constellation of satellites that provide navigation services to other satellites. And so when these satellites launched, they were put into a bad orbit, and the satellites themselves were tumbling out of control. And so normally this is it, the mission is over. You've failed to get your spacecraft into the right orbit and now you have to start again. But the Chinese engineers working on this did the math and realized that they could probably save these satellites, but it would require some clever tricks. So they split into two groups. One group figured out how to remove the spin, and the other group calculated a series of trajectories that they could take with these spacecraft to do gravitational slingshots and use the gravity of the sun to push them into the correct orbit. And after 123 days of doing multiple slingshots around the Earth and the moon, they were able to get the satellites into their final proper orbit. And we've got a more detailed story about that from Matt Williams on Universe Today, where you tell us what you thought was the best story of the week. And the winner this week was the discovery of a potential biosignature at Kepler K2-18b. And my overly skeptical response? I'm not sure. Anyway, thank you everybody who voted. And of course, we post this poll into the post tab here on YouTube within about 24 hours of when we post the new episode of Space Bites. So if you're scrolling on YouTube and the poll comes up, vote for the story that you thought was the best and we will celebrate it next week. Of course, the best chance is to be subscribed to the channel, click on the notifications bell, and then just do everything the algorithm tells you to do forever. Bacteria that can mimic multicellular life. Now, while single cellular life has been around on Earth really as long as it could, the second Earth cooled down that life could exist, life did exist. But it wasn't until 1.2 billion years ago that we finally got multicellular life. And obviously, like, there had to be some series of evolutionary steps that went on to bring separate organisms together. And one of the main theories for how this happened is called the colonial theory. And what you get is a bunch of what were then identical bacteria huddling, hanging out together, and they started to gain some kind of evolutionary advantage by being part of a larger mass. And then some of them started to differentiate into different kinds of function and then use chemical signals to pass information back and forth to share resources among the colony. All multicellular life on Earth is derived from a common ancestor, but there is a type of bacteria that is doing this trick today. They're called magnetotactic bacteria, and they use the Earth's magnetic field to move around and to orient themselves. And they collect together into these large colonies of bacteria. And now they can't survive on their own without being in this colony. And so there's a new NASA-funded study that looks into what's going on in these colonies of these magnetotactic bacteria. And they find that they have slightly different genetic blueprints. They perform different functions as part of this colony. Although it's not actual multicellular life, it's a really interesting insight into how these kinds of life forms might have evolved. And we've got a great story about this from Evan Goff on Universe Today. A planet orbiting two brown dwarfs. Here in the solar system, all of the planets are arranged in this flat disk that surrounds the equator of the sun. Now, some of the planets are a little higher in their orbits, but roughly there is this flat plane extending out from the center of the sun, and all of the planets are in that. And as we have discovered, more and more planets orbiting around other stars, we see the same thing. And this tells us about the evolution and how these planetary systems formed. You had this cloud of gas and dust that collapsed down, it spun up, it flattened out, and then you got the planets forming in this protoplanetary disk around the star. Okay, great. But now astronomers think they've found an example of a planet that is orbiting perpendicular, in other words, at a 90 degree angle to the equator of the stars in the system. And I say stars because there are two of them, and they're not really stars, they're brown dwarfs. But what they found is you've got two brown dwarfs orbiting around each other, and then a planet that is orbiting perpendicularly to both of those brown dwarfs. So how do you get something like this? Well, because there are two brown dwarfs orbiting around each other, a common center of mass, this gives the opportunity for three-body interactions. And so you could have started out with a planet orbiting within this planetary system in a more normal orientation, and then over time it was slowly kicked into this new orbit, and then the orbital resonances kicked in and locked it in place. And this is the first time that astronomers have found a planet orbiting at a perpendicular configuration around two stars. And we've got a story about this from Mark Thompson on Universe Today. Almost a quarter of all lunar ejecta eventually hits the Earth. Have you read the book Seven Eves? So in the book, there is some disaster happens to the moon. It breaks apart, and then all of the debris from the moon ends up in low Earth orbit, and a lot of it crashes into the Earth, and that heats up the planet and causes a disaster, and then that's what the book is about. And so you wonder, like, is this likely? Well, astronomers have done some simulations to see what happens to material that is ejected off of the surface of the moon. And you would need some kind of impact onto the moon, a large asteroid to hit the moon, throw up enough debris that this material reaches the lunar escape velocity. Now it's actually going into orbit around the Earth and eventually around the sun. And according to their calculations, within 10,000 years, about a quarter of all of that ejected material hits the Earth, and then a lot more of it remains in the region. And this is interesting because astronomers have found quasi-moons that are orbiting close to the Earth, and these asteroids share a lot in common with the chemistry of the moon. And so what it might be is that you had large asteroids hit the moon in the past, much of the material ended up on the Earth, but some of it also went into orbit around the sun in an orbit that is very similar to the Earth's orbit, and they come back from time to time and maybe later on smash into the Earth. And so this is actually a whole new source of near Earth objects. And now it's time for some cool images. And so first up, this is the Sombrero Galaxy. And this is a very famous image, and we got a new version of it from the Hubble Space Telescope. And Sombrero is pretty amazing. It's located about 30 million light years away, and it has a supermassive black hole with a billion times the mass of the sun. But it's only about the same size as the Milky Way, so a lot more mass packed into this very small area. And it has about 10 times as many globular clusters orbiting around it. It is thought to be the brightest galaxy within about a 30 million light year radius. And it's just one of my favorite objects out there in space. And speaking of the Hubble Space Telescope, the telescope just celebrated its 35th birthday in space. Like, I don't want to make you feel old, but this telescope has been there in space for 35 years now. And to celebrate, astronomers working with Hubble released a bunch of new images that we've never seen. So first up, we've got an image of Mars that was taken by Hubble when it was at its closest to Earth back in December. Then we've got an image of just a small portion of the Rosette Nebula, and then the planetary nebula NGC 2899. And then finally, the spiral galaxy NGC 5335, which has this really bizarre bar right through the middle of the galaxy. And the final image that I want to share with you was actually just released today when I'm recording this. And this is the sun, of course, taken by the European Space Agency's Solar Orbiter. And this image was taken when Solar Orbiter was about 77 million kilometers away from the sun, which is about half the distance from the Earth to the sun. So much closer. And in fact, it's not a single image. It is a mosaic of 200 separate images taken by Solar Orbiter. It did these images over a 5x5 grid, but with multiple different wavelengths. And then astronomers took all of these images, stitched them together into this single gigantic Mosaic. And I can't express to you how big this image is. Like, if you want to download it, it's a 157 megapixel image. And the version that they have on ESA's website allows you to zoom in and look at particular features like coronal loops or filaments across the surface of the sun. And so it's just an absolutely mind-bending image of the sun. Now, while you're watching this week's episode of Space Bites, I am writing my weekly email newsletter, The Guide to Space. For example, here are some of the stories that we've got in the newsletter that you won't see here on Space Bites. Astronaut Don Pettit is celebrating his 70th birthday by returning to the crushing Earth gravity. And that's a story by Matt Williams. Scientists are asking for help to clarify galaxies from cosmic noon. And that's a story by Andy Tomaswick. And seeing the waves that make the sun's corona so hot. And that's a story by Dr. Brian Koberlein. So if you want to get access to those additional stories, sign up to the newsletter. I send it out to 70,000 people every Friday. I write every word. There's no ads. It's completely free. Go to universetoday.com/newsletter to sign up. And if you want even more space news, we release another version of this video over on Patreon that we call Space Bites Plus. It has one additional story. And this week's story is all about a concept for a human mission to Mars and asteroid Ceres that could be completed within 5 years. I'll put a link in the show notes so you can watch the same version over there. I'm going to give you even some more images that I've taken with my C-Star S50 telescope, but first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Andrew M. Gross, Bear Lake Roofing, Brian Bodie, Caredwin, Chuck Hawkins, Commander Baylock, Cy Nielsen, David Gilton, and David Matz, Dustin Cable, Evan Pro, Greg Feely, Hen Schultz, Hudson Moore, Jay Graves, James Clark, Jeremy Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Marcel Smits, Michael Purcell, Modso, Paul Robach, Ren Kaidu, Robeck, Sean Sargent, Stephen Found the Munley, Vlad Chiplin, and Wolfgang Klotz, who support us at the Master of the Universe level. And all our patrons, all your support means the universe to us. So in the QA this week, I shared some initial terrible images that I took with the C-Star S50. And now I'm getting a better handle on how to use this telescope. And in fact, I was able to use the planning mode where you plot out how you want the telescope to take images all night. And so I set it up, configured it to take just 4 pictures. And then I just let it run all night. Went to bed, woke up in the morning, there were the pictures. It's incredible. And, you know, for such a small aperture, I'm really amazed. I know it sounds like I'm sponsored by this company. I promise I'm not. I'm just excited about the capability of this telescope. And apparently, you can continue using the telescope, continue taking images of the same object, and we'll just keep stacking up images. So I'm going to see if I can make these images better and better and better over the coming weeks. And, you know, a lot of you have been wondering what's happening with the star parties that we're doing. And so the new plan is that we're probably going to be incorporating these sea stars into the star parties because they're actually really easy to use. So we've sort of gone back and come up with an entirely new way that we're going to do this. And I will keep you posted as soon as we're able to go live with that again. But probably within a couple of weeks, we'll be able to come back with a much more stable solution using this technological platform and our help from Starfront. All right, we will see you next week.